Good evening, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, David.
For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. I'm nervous now, I don't have mine. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. So this evening we're discussing step one. We spend 2 weeks on step one. Last week we discussed the physical allergy, and tonight we're gonna focus primarily on the obsession of the mind, the twofold problem that we have. And Patrick and Jill are gonna share with us tonight. So I'm going to just read a paragraph, and then we'll kick it off. So we're on page 5 in the big book. Should be in Bill's story at this point. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. Jill?
I'm Jill, an alcoholic.
Okay,
this is talking about the mental obsession. And I love this because from the time I was a little kid, I said there was nothing I couldn't do if I put my mind to it, damn it. And even as a little kid, I was saying, damn it. So what happened was, what I found out is I tried to control my drinking at times, but most usually I didn't even try to control it. I was pretty wide open with it. But at times I did. I can remember one year moving out to South Hill, Virginia, I was going to become Mother Earth. And I did pretty good with that for a little while, very short while. But it didn't take long because farmers drink too. They drink a lot. And I seemed to always find the ones that did. And when it would happen, I would say, well, beer is kind of organic, you know. It's not really all that bad. But what I didn't realize is I couldn't stop. That, you know, we're talking about powerlessness here. And I didn't believe I was powerless over this. There was no way that I was powerless over this much booze in a glass. I could conquer anything. But what happened was through a series of trying to do this over and over, making a resolve, making a promise, making giving myself really great pep talks. I even have this book that I bought sometime in this cycle was what to say to yourself when you talk to you. What do you say when you talk to yourself? You know, because they already knew I was talking to myself. And so, you know, it was kind of coming up with affirmations, affirmative statements to pump up your resolve. And I had a whole list of them written down, you know, things I wanted to be healthier, I'd even do some little bit more exercise or whatever I had to do. But I honestly believe this was mind over matter, that it wasn't anything that, it wasn't going to get the best of me. And I always thought of alcoholism as a character, a flaw of people, you know, that they were weak-willed people that just didn't have any fortitude, you know, if you really tried hard enough. And then what I came up with was, well, I didn't really want to quit. This was my idea anyway. So see, I kept changing the rules. At first, when I did want to quit, I would say, you know, I just need to try harder. Then when I realized I couldn't, I changed the rules and go, well, I didn't want to anyway. So it was, it had to be my idea, and no matter what I did. But what I found out later, this is talking about the mental obsession. And wishing to quit, wishing to not drink, has no effect whatsoever on that. I could wish and want all I want, all I could, but I didn't have the power. I was lacking the power to do this. And that we'll talk about that more as this goes on. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
My name is Patrick Lanier. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Patrick.
My sobriety date's May 1st, 2009. My home group's the Principal's Group of Chesapeake. We meet on Tuesdays. You know, it says here, I woke up. And I just like to think when I woke up, you know, nights after the allergy ran a little too wild on me, and I wake up and I got that taste in my mouth. It's just disgusting. And I'm not going to say words. I'm trying not to swear what my mouth tastes like, but you can imagine. And my head's just throbbing. And it's the morning. And maybe I'm in a bullpen. Maybe I'm in my own bed. Who knows? Maybe there's vomit all next to the side of the bed. And I'm thinking about how, like, I can't be doing this anymore. I don't want to be living like this. And if it's a bullpen, you know, then I instantly jump on the phone. You know, just because I went to jail, it's not what makes me an alcoholic, just because I went to prison. But, you know, I think if Mr. Hyde was running around, he'd probably spend a little time in prison. I know it's something that says in the description. And so that's a lot of times where I did wake up. And then comes the sweet promises, you know, and I would start writing them. I've spent years writing every week sweet promises to my parents, to my siblings, to the mother of my child about how it's going to be different. I'm going to get out. I'm going to go to community college, you know. This in everything, I mean business. Everything's different this time. I'm telling you, and I believe it in my heart. You can strap me up to a lie detector test, and I will pass that every time. Because I believe it's going to be different this time. And I will set forth and tell you my plan of action on how it's going to be different, you know. I'm going to get my own apartment. I'm going to have my daughter half the year. I'm going to go to community college, someplace I've never been before. But I love to tell people I'm going to community college because I believe that's going to fix it. That's going to fix it. Get those duckies in a row and my whole life will become better. I get a great girlfriend. I get a great job. I get a great house and everything's going to be wonderful. But, you know, shortly afterward, they let me out and I'm drunk again. Oh, man. How did this happen? And then, you know, it's that cycle. Just keeps going and going. And, you know, am I crazy? I don't know. I don't like to think of myself as crazy. I like to think of myself as I got a lot of bad luck. Some people have horseshoes up their butt, and I just didn't get one installed in me, you know? I have a lot of bad luck. I got a district attorney that doesn't like me. You know, I got a probation officer breathing down my throat. I was adopted. Oh man, we can blame a lot of things on that. You know, I got all these reasons why these things happen. It's not really drinking, no. And you know, when people want to talk to me about my drinking, well, I'll definitely evade that subject, or we're going to talk about something else. Because I'm not going to talk about that. And why is that? I know we're going to get into it more. But for me, when I took that first drink, when I was a kid, I had a spiritual experience. Life got real good real quick. All of a sudden, my clothes that don't fit me, I'm either too fat or too skinny, I'm just right. I turned into Goldilocks instantly the second I took that first drink. And that's what happened, you know? But I hear this, you know, renewing my resolve. I go and I do this over and over. And yes, there have been times when I've been cocky, and there have been times when I'm just going to drink beer and just drink Michelob Ultra. I'm going to the gym trying to lose weight. Makes a lot of sense. Never once drinking any Michelob Ultra. Going right back to the bar and hitting the Jameson again. And I love that, too, because he says, as the whiskey rose to my head, I remember so many times spending the whole day at work saying, I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm not going to drink tonight. And then it was like a magnet. Just, I'm in the bar, and it just happens to be, oh, I'm drinking Jameson. I love it. Nights I have a lot of money, maybe we'll do some Chevys, but usually it's Jameson, and that usually turns into Aristocrat or Old Crow as the money dwindles down. But yes, the whiskey rises to my head, and I have had those thoughts. What the heck? How am I doing this? I need to pay my child support. I need to pay all these bills that I've accumulated from lack of work because I've been locked up in penal institutions. I need to be, what am I doing? Whatever, I'll try again tomorrow. That's all I got, thanks.
Okay, we're gonna press on to page 7. I think we're also still in Bill's story at this point. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. Jill?
Okay, in this one, in these paragraphs, when they talk about the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating alcohol, in combating it, yes, but my will was extremely strong when it came to drinking. You know, I had all kinds of reasons why I shouldn't be drinking. I mean, there were a lot of them. And I've been in the hospital for alcohol poisoning. I'd had doctors and psychiatrists telling me, you know, you've got the mind of a chronic alcoholic. And I'd go, well, here's to you. And I had cancer in 93, which was a direct result of alcoholism. Alcoholic women have a much higher incidence of breast cancer than anybody else. And when they were trying to talk to me about it, she said, well, how much do you drink? Well, I hardly ever drink. I mean, what a lie, huh? But I would do anything to protect my drinking, anything. But it took an amazing amount of willpower in the face of all of that that said, you know, you really should stop, to keep doing it, you know, to do something that's killing you. And when they say, you know, is this incredible behavior in the face of this desperate desire to stop? It's incredible behavior in somebody that knows some facts. You know, I've got some facts about what this stuff is doing, and I've read some articles, and I do know what alcohol does to people. I come from a family of alcoholics, and it's not pretty. I mean, we've had some horrendous things happen in my family, but you know what I always told myself? It won't happen to me. I can tell myself some lies. I really can. But what I thought self-knowledge was is, if I have the knowledge about this, it wasn't even that the self-knowledge, if I had the knowledge about it, I could conquer it. You know, that's what I always felt like, knowledge was power. But I could know everything there is to know about alcoholism and still drink myself to death. And that's been kind of an awakening in the program, because I've listened to some tapes recently, and one of them, it says the greatest line, you know, we've never had anyone in here too dumb to get sober, but we sure have had some people too smart. And unfortunately, that's been kind of true for me at times. I mean, my biggest block sometimes is just my what I think of my brain. You know, I think it's really smart. But what the sentence that made a big impression on me on this is, the curve of my decline, moral and bodily health, fell off like a ski jump. In 94, I came into the program, and because I had been seeing a psychiatrist that says I needed this. So I'm in here, and I've got some knowledge now. You know, I do to see this. My drinking's been really bad. I need to stop, okay? And I didn't realize at the time I couldn't. But what I told myself was I didn't want to. But boy, I tell you what, when I went back out in 94 until I got in here in 96, you talk about a ski jump. It went, I mean, especially mentally, I became so dead to everything around me. There wasn't anything that got through to me. You know, so I had very few feelings. I was really just every day getting up. I worked, go to work, come home, drink until I passed out. I wasn't sleeping at all. I was passing out and coming to. Passing out and coming to. My health was terrible. My stomach, I didn't eat. When I was drinking, I was one of these people, I didn't eat. Who wants to ruin a good buzz, right? And then when I did eat, I would eat things like nachos, you know, at 11 o'clock at night, something you really throw up on. And so I wasn't eating anything healthy. But what I noticed more than anything was the mental. I was just really all the time in such a fog and so much anger. I think that's the thing that bothered me more than anything is this. I was so volatile, could not control any of that anymore. And the people around me, I'd kicked them all out a long time ago, but the people I worked with and stuff like that, nobody really wanted to be around me because it was too uncomfortable. It's like, what is she going to be like today? What's going to happen today? And nobody knows what to do with me. You know, it's like, you know, what do you do with someone that's just as bound and determined they're going to drink themselves to death? And so I think at some point in here, God has to intervene, because if he didn't, I have no doubt today I would have finished that job. But there's a great story around that, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Thanks.
Thanks, Jill. Let's see, you know, self-knowledge. Well, knowing the solution, I know anything with self in the beginning isn't going to help me much. But it relieved me somewhat to learn that the alcoholic's the will is amazingly weakened. And that's, you know, that's what I was talking about, that magnet that just pulled me into the bar. And, you know, to be drinking till 2 every night, closing down the bar, but able to still go to work the next day. Now, that right there explains that, because it often remains strong in other respects. Wow, I could still drag my sorry self to work in the morning. I could get there. I mean, alcohol ain't gonna pay for itself, and I got too much of an ego to panhandle. So I'm gonna be at work on time, I know that. And, you know, and so this goes on. I remember, you know, I had to go to a substance abuse counselor twice in my drinking career. The first time I was somewhat truthful, but not really truthful. And I remember we had a lot of talk about me getting hobbies, and she was talking to me about her hobby of fly fishing. And I nodded and shook my head, because she was signing some papers to the judge. Yeah, it sounds like a great idea. You know, nothing better than getting up early in the morning, putting on some rubber pants, doing the freezing cold, and flipping a switch back and forth. Sounds marvelous. That's what I want to do. No, not at all. But definitely, you know, I the monkey can dance when the flame's on me, and I can dance very well. And so I do what they say. And then the second time was a little different when I went to a substance abuse counselor. I had a talk with the mother of my child before I went, and she's like, listen, this is the trick. She said, it's the truth if you believe it. And I'm like, yeah, I don't drink. And I went in there, and I should have gotten an Academy Award for that performance, because I was in there for a DUI, and they had the paperwork in front of them, And I was like, I don't drink. And I took their little test, and I passed their test with that mindset. They asked the questions different ways, whatever which way they could, switched words around. I don't drink, I don't drink, I don't drink. I just kept that going in my head. And then we had a talk after, and she's like, you passed this test. She's like, why were you driving around drunk with an open container? Well, I just got a new job. I don't really like to drink, but my coworkers talked me into coming out, you know, the camaraderie, and then, you know. And then, and she's like, well, why was the open container? Oh, well, see, the mother of my child, she was driving around the night before with her friend, and her friend, you know, they were drinking. I tell them not to do that all the time, because, you know, you're going to get, and like, I'm just selling it, because no, I'm not stopping drinking. I will do whatever means necessary to keep doing what I'm doing. And she bought it. She did. And she gave me my paper signed for probation, and I skipped forth with that. But I didn't even read a pamphlet when I was in the office, because this wasn't even on the table yet of stopping drinking. In my head, I needed to grow up. I'm still rather young. I just need to grow up, become a productive member of society. That day is just going to hit me. Maybe someday in my late 20s or 30s. I'm not exactly sure when, but I just need to grow up. And men, they grow up, you know, a little bit older than women. All these crazy thoughts, I just sell myself all the time, over and over and over and over. And they, and but then the frightful day did come, and my bodily health, yeah, it fell off. I found myself in Norfolk, right across the street over in Norfolk General in the ICU. And that was the first time. I didn't develop wet brain, but I had the little accordion going next to me, and that was the first time when I was like, huh, you know what, maybe this drinking thing needs to stop, you know? And my idea was, I'm going to go to AA and I'm going to learn how to not drink. That's what I thought when I came here. That wasn't the lesson I was taught, but that's all I got.
All right. We're going to continue on page 24. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. Jill?
You know, this is, when it's in italics, it means it's really important. And it's the fact that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice. When I hear someone say, I choose not to drink today, I want to always go up and go, how did you do that? Because I would some mornings get up, and if there was anything left from the night before, this is when I was really trying to get this under control. And if I had anything left in the bottle, I'd pour it down the sink and go, today I'm not going to drink. Today is the day that I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink now for a whole week. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, my mind would change. It would just slowly go, well, I might just have one or maybe two. And then when I'd go home and I'd have a drink, I'd go, I've already had two, I'll just have three. And then after that, I can turn my mind off. Who's counting anyway? I can do that in a heartbeat. And that's kind of scary to know that today, but when I say I was really dead when I got here, my mind had shut down so bad that I could do, that's the only way you could drink like I did, was to just not listen to that. It just becomes dead. And it wasn't a fifth. I mean, I would spend weekends getting up in the morning and think, well, I've got to clean this house today. I'm just going to have a little something this morning. And it would just, I'd have orange juice with my bourbon just to get a little vitamin C in there. And clean house. I was going to clean house. And what would happen would I'd pass out. Well, I'll clean house this afternoon when I wake up. I'd wake up and I think, oh, you know what? I just really want a drink. I want to... just a little drink, that'll give me the energy to clean house. That's a cycle. And I'd hate to say, tell you all this, but I did that over and over and over. And then sometimes it would be, I can remember a few times, and one of them was really embarrassing. I had gone somewhere with some people to a really nice event. And I always said, when I would go to these things, I would say, I'm going to really watch what I'm drinking. And I wouldn't necessarily get, I didn't go very often. Towards the end, I didn't go anywhere to speak of because I couldn't predict it. But I had gotten mad. I was trying to control my drinking, and what happened was I got mad. And more I tried to not be mad over whatever had happened, the angrier I got. And I looked like a fool. I looked like an absolute fool. And I demanded to be driven home. And the guy, I can remember saying, you know, well, what happened? What happened? What was going on? And I couldn't tell him. I just need a drink so bad, I got to get out of here. But what it was you're an asshole and I can't stand to be around you. Is what that sounded a lot better than I need a drink. So made sense at the time. But the fact that I was powerless over this, I was without defense. When I came in 94, I came to like 5 or 6 AA meetings. And I thought that what this was just a nice bunch of people who were going to help me. You know, you're going to help me. But what it was that when they were telling me you're powerless over this, that you need to, you're going to, if you ask for help and you take the action that we take, you won't want to drink. I didn't believe that. I just believed I'd come here, get the book, and I would not drink. Well, I got, in the afternoon, I had had some liquor in the house, and I just decided to have a drink. And the lady that was trying to help me, she called me, or I called her one, and she asked me the magic question. I must have been slurring. Have you been drinking? And I said, yes. And she said, well, you just aren't ready. And I didn't realize that at the time. I thought it was my choice to take that drink. I thought it was my choice. And the fact was that booze was in the house, and there was no way I could leave it alone. I was going to drink it if it was there. And the almost certain consequences, they didn't even come into my mind. And I couldn't even have brought up that there would be a consequence. It was to the point then where I would have done just about anything just to keep drinking. Consequences never stopped me. Looking like a fool, being so sick I can't hardly function. None of it mattered. I mean, I gave up marriages and family and a whole lot of things just to pursue this. And the old threadbare idea that this time it'll be different, that I did that every time I drank, I think. You know, this time I'm just going to have a couple and just take the edge off. Just relax. I'm going to just relax tonight. And I'm thinking that one or two drinks is going to do that. And what's happening is one or two drinks, it actually kicks in that compulsion, that obsession. And it just, you know, that takes over. And I am completely powerless to stop that until something happens to make me stop. And usually what happened to make me stop was I'd pass out. I mean, and, you know, I see other people, they you know, and a person that doesn't have alcoholism, they stop because they start feeling it. You know, I think I'm feeling better as I drink. So I drink more. You know, I want to feel better and better. So that's a good reason to keep drinking. Thanks. That's all I have.
Thanks, Jeff.
This is what we're talking about, the obsession. And, you know, I love it, dude. Everyone, you know, we got the obsession and the allergy. I don't really care too much about the allergy. I really don't today. I care more about this obsession because that's what always is going to lead me back to the craziness. And I hear it, and I hear it from people that, like, I really respect their sobriety, but people say it in such a nonchalant way, like, just don't drink today. Just don't drink today. Really? Like, really? It's that easy? And, you know, when we say that, newcomers might sometimes believe, you know, if you don't drink today, you're a success. Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, I might put cigarettes out on the kids at home, but I didn't have a drink today, so I'm a success. And that's the thing. No. Like, this was the selling point for me when I came into AA. It wasn't the war stories that my sponsor had, because I really thought he had a weak game when it came to drinking, to be honest with you. It wasn't his war stories that sold me. It's when he started to talk to me about about this idea that I don't have a choice in drinking, that I'm going to drink good, bad, or indifferent. Good girlfriend, bad girlfriend. Good job, bad job. No matter what, I'm always going to take that first drink. That was the selling point. That started to make some sense when a lot of other things didn't make sense to me. And, you know, and the humiliation and the suffering of even a week ago, that is a very good selling point, because why is it that I just got out of prison with all those sweet promises and now I'm back doing the same thing again? People look at me like I'm mildly retarded, and I don't, I really am. My actions make me look like that. That's what I am. And so, you know, and I love that we're without defense against the first drink. Because I can't remember. I can't remember my war stories. Huh, imagine that. But I'm going to come in AA and I'm going to get scared by your guys' war stories when I can't even remember my own. That's craziness. And when that was talked to me about how that obsession and how that I always go back, like, that's made so much sense. And like the power of choice in drinking, I think it says it in the long form, the 12 tradition, to remember, to always remember who presides over us all, you know, that in like to remember the only reason I'm sober today is by the grace of God. It's not my doing. I was at work the other day and I nonchalantly told one of my coworkers, oh, I haven't had a drink in 5 years today. And the first thing, because she's normal, she's like, that is a lot of willpower. And I'm like... Not exactly, but I'm not going to go, I just left it at that, not exactly. And I left it at that, I'm not going to go and explain alcoholism to her. But yeah, there's no freaking willpower. I've tried willpower, and it didn't work. And then, you know, it talks from the failure, the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. And yes, the stove has been very hot in my life, but also... Before it gets that hot, when I put my hand there, it gives me a lot of ease and comfort. Like I already said, you know, instantly it's like I'm Goldilocks, finding the magical, the porridge is just right, the bed's just right. Everything when I take that drink feels just right, you know. No matter what is going on in my life, everything feels all right. The second I take a drink, the second before the alcohol even hits my bloodstream, the world becomes an easier, softer place. It does. You can just see the pressure come off my shoulders. It's just like, and like, how can I not go and do that? Even with all these consequences, how can I not? I can't live in this state, just all tensed up, want to fight everybody, am fighting everyone, screaming at everyone, spackling walls left and right from punching holes in them. And like, I can't live like that. I need a drink. Drinking's my solution. And that makes a lot of sense with that obsession, why I'm always going back. No, I'm not, you know, who cares about the allergy? The obsession is what's going to get me. And yeah, I understand, like, if I don't take the first drink, I won't get drunk. But how am I going to get rid of that obsession that always drives me to the first freaking drink? Thanks.
We're going to continue on page 34. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps the medical fraternity, so we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Jill?
When I was drinking, I honestly thought I drank like other people. I didn't realize that what alcohol did for me, it doesn't do to 9 out of 10 people. 1 out of 10 people get the effect that I get from alcohol. which is ease and comfort. And when people used to say, I had a friend that said, you're wound up tighter than a tick until you have a drink or two. And it was true. I was just always keyed up and just anxious or just really fidgety. Even when I was a little kid, I was never calm. And so when I drank, it was just like Patrick said, that ease. It was like an instant. Like, I was in therapy for years, way long. And I got more relief from a couple of shots of bourbon than I ever got from hours of telling on my woes. Because talking about my problem to someone didn't give me any relief. It just was talk. You know, it just seemed it's time to, it was a, kind of like for me, it was a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. But when I took a couple of drinks, my whole personality changes. It changes from being a keyed up, fearful, anxious person to being hot, you know, just being really just right in there with the rest of the world. I've got it all under control, and I just really am on the top of the world. So when we think about that, I think about the moderate drinker. You know, I never drank with moderate drinkers to speak of. I like people that drink like I did. So I was always comparing myself to other alcoholics, mostly. So the baffling feature of alcoholism is the utter inability to leave it alone. And even when I came home from coming out of the hospital that time for alcohol poisoning, I mean, I'd just been in the hospital, very sick. I came home and walked in the kitchen, and it's like, you know, this is probably one thing you want to avoid now is drinking so much that you get alcohol poisoning. So I walk to the kitchen sink and I pour a glass of bourbon and I stand there at the sink, shaking like a leaf, and I drink it. The inner inability to leave it alone, no matter what I have to, I just came out of a hospital. I knew it was pretty serious. But the first thing I did was take a drink. I could not do it. So when they say the experiment of quitting for a period of time, I did that. I would say if I cannot drink for a month, I'm not an alcoholic. I actually had a friend and we counted down the days that we didn't drink. And that was not towards the end, by the way. Trust me. And I did it a few times. So there's nothing like success to drink, to have a drink at, you know? We did it. Whoa. But as I drank longer and longer, I couldn't do that. I could not do that. And when it says, what kind of thinking dominates the alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? What the thinking that dominated me was that it was my idea. I drink because I want to. So there. Even if it does look bad, even though it is, you know, it's got consequences, it's my idea. I'm doing it because I want to. And it's not true. Or I'm drinking because I can remember at times I'd come home, I'd had a bad day, and I just need to take the edge off. So I'm going to have a drink to take the edge off. I could have taken a lot of edges off with the amount I drank. But then it could be, but then other times it was so good. What kind of thinking? It was so great. I think I need to celebrate tonight. You know, I'm just going to have a drink. And that's what I always said, I'm going to have a drink. I never sat down going to say, I'm going to drink a quarter bourbon tonight. I'm going to drink a fifth of vodka. I never did that. I just said, I'm going to have a drink. So already I'm lying to myself. I'm always lying to myself about what's going on, what I'm doing, and what it means. And in here it says, friends who have reasoned after a spree, which had brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. I remember my cousin was living with me at the end of my drinking, and she would say, why do you drink like that? She says, you used to do a whole lot of really neat things. Now all you do is drink. Why would you do that? It can't be fun. She said, you're not doing anything, so we know we're not having, you know, and how can I tell her? I'm having fun in my head. It's a blast up here. I mean, that's the only place that's fun. I'm not living life, but boy, up here it looks good. This is what I'm going to do when I do have fun. So, I mean, it's like, and how do you explain that to anybody? You don't. You just got to keep quiet. But the thinking is, I don't see that thinking as anything wrong with it. I see that thinking as real. You know, this is good thinking. You know, because I got these brilliant ideas. Sometimes I'd write them down. I watched a lot of PBS back then, and I'd write down things I'd seen or things I'd heard, books I was going to read, you know. In the morning, you can't read what I wrote, you know, but I wrote it down. But it's like, so at that time, everything that's going on in my world is going on in my head. It's not going on anywhere else. And so life has passed me by, and the people around me are completely mystified by, why is she doing that? And you can't explain to someone why you're doing it. At least I couldn't. Thanks.
All right. I guess the best way to explain this for me is to talk a little bit what it was like when I quit drinking. First of all, you know, I was unable to drink moderately. I already knew that. And we're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. I desired to stop. I remember when I was in Norfolk General, I looked over at my dad, and he had this look on his face, and I was begging the neurosurgeon, well, I was pleading to the neurosurgeon, screaming at her, why didn't you just let me die the night before? And I looked over at him, and this thought went through my head that if I was going to have any life whatsoever, I can never take a drink again. And so I desired to stop. And then my next plan of action was, I'm in a lot of trouble. I'm going to go to rehab, and I'm going to start going to meetings. And so that's what I did. I went up to Winchester, and then I came, when I was in Winchester, they were just pumping us through meetings. And then I came back, and I started going to a lot of meetings in Chesapeake. I think I did a 90 in 2 months, 90 and 60. And that's where I get to this period, because, you know, it says here that the non-spiritual basis, going to meetings, is, I guess it's semi-spiritual. It depends for the reasons why I'm there. You know, when I was going to meetings, I'm telling war stories about how bad I am because I want to be badder than everyone else in the room. And, like, I don't really know anything about this, getting a relationship with God and what the rest of this book is going to tell me. So they're really, me going to meetings was really doing absolutely nothing. And my dad, you know, he sent me to rehab thinking that this was going to be was going to solve the problem. And I come back and I'm worse than ever. He asked me to mow the lawn. I tell him to go mow his own effing yard. And this is how I am. And he's just got this look on his face like, what happened? You go to rehab and you come back. Well, yeah, folks, I put the plug in the jug. Life is wonderful now, isn't it? I'm sitting in meetings going off about how, you know, how bad I am. And then when I'm listening to that old guy, I'm thinking about punching his face in. And then I'm outside pacing back and forth, smoking cigarette after cigarette after cigarette. And I just need a drink. But I don't know. I haven't really read any of your books. I've listened to you in meetings. Tell me about acceptance is the answer to all my problems. And I'm accepting it. I'm accepting this. Well, I want to just punch a baby, you know. I'm fit to be tied. And so, you know, we come back to here, and I wanted to stop. And then all of a sudden, that sort of thinking came. I was actually not in a meeting in Chesapeake. I was in a meeting in Norfolk. I don't know. It was a fine meeting. Nothing crazy about it. They weren't talking about acceptance. So that's a plus. And I'm in this meeting, and it just all of a sudden, bing, I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I need to go take a drink. And, like, I have every reason in the world not to drink. I'm about ready to go back to prison. Like, maybe I can, like, show the judge that I've been doing something. I have every reason. My parents are done. They've just thrown so much money at this problem, and I'm being a little jerk at home. You know, baby's mother does not want to talk to me. I have been late on all my child support payments. I have every reason not to take a drink, and it's just like, bam. When I get back to Chesapeake, I'm going to AJ Gators on Cedar Road, and I'm done with this. Thought went through my head that how am I going to show my face in prison to going to these self-help programs? And I've just sat in two months of meetings, and I think it's a self-help program. That's what I was pulling out of the meetings. And I was going. I remember I was at the Coast Guard Exchange pacing back and forth like a tiger, just back and forth. It was hot. And I'm like, screw it. I'll give this Alcoholics Anonymous one shot. And I called up the guy that turned out to be my sponsor. And he started talking to me about the obsession, about why. Like, when I told him about me telling to mow my dad to mow his own lawn, he started laughing. He understood. When I told him how bad I wanted to drink, he's like, of course you do. Of course you do. I'm like, what do you mean, of course? He's like, you cannot drink. The only thing that we got for you is hopefully an adequate substitute that you'll find in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like, well, how many meetings do I need to go to accomplish that? It's not about the meetings, he tells me. It's not about the meetings. It's a 12-step program. It's about the 12 steps. And I'm like, and he starts talking to me like this, telling me about how I'm irritable, restless, discontent, how I see the world is, you know, just a terrible place. I hate people. Don't discriminate my hatred. And he's telling me all this through himself, his own experience. And I'm like, oh, my God, this guy knows what he's talking about. And I sat 2 months, and I didn't, 2 months of means, I don't remember hearing that. Maybe I wasn't listening. Maybe I need to clean my ears out. But he started saying that, and that was the only thing that saved me that day from walking directly into a bar, sitting down, and I probably would not be up here right now. Thanks.
Awesome. All right. I don't know where we are. Okay. At this point in the book, they start telling a couple of different stories, like jaywalkers and the guy putting the whiskey in the milk, etc. On page 37, whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How could such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity, how could have this happened? Yep.
Okay. The insanity for in taking the first drink for me was always that it was going to be different, or that it would that I could keep getting the ease and comfort. At the end of my drinking, there were times when there was ease and comfort. There were plenty of times where there was total blackout and there was no ease and comfort. I was still in a rage, no matter what I was doing. So, in his when we think about this, and I don't think that I'm powerless over this, or that I don't think that alcoholism is progressive. See, that's the thing I didn't buy into. I thought that I had just a drinking problem, you know, and if I could stop for a little while, I could get my act together, and then I could go back to what it used to be, you know, when it was the ease and comfort and it was the fun. And I never stopped long enough to really play that out, that it was progressive. I didn't see that until I was in the program for a while, about how my disease had progressed. But when I was trying to do this, it's the frustration in trying to do this. When I was drinking, I drank every day, and I drank a lot every day. But the foolish idea was that, you know, if I could stop for a little while, it would diminish that tremendous amount I was having to consume to get the same effect would diminish, and I could go back to having a couple of drinks. But it's when I would try to do that, it would be like I would be just so full of angst. I would just be so wound up, so just about ready to come apart. I was sure sometimes that I was just either going to implode or explode. You know, I was going to nuke something or else I was going to die. And so I was always thinking of, okay, when I'm not drinking, I'm feeling like this. But then the real problem came when I was drinking, I was feeling like that. Mm-hmm. You know, when there's no relief, with it or without it, that's a hard place. And then also at the end of my drinking, there was no, some days it would be good, some days I could be really, it could be funny, it could be just very light, but just as often, it could be very dark, and I would be just about suicidal, whether I was drinking or not. So when you get into that place, point, they talk about a trivial excuse to take the first drink. The trivial excuse just became that I needed a drink. I just needed a drink. I didn't have any, you know, my shoelace didn't break. Nothing major happened. I just needed to drink. That was all I needed. That was the trivial excuse I needed. Because my body craved it so bad, and I didn't know how to not do it. So when, and it's funny, because you come to AA, and it really was one day at a time for me. I slept a lot. I was so tired when I got here, because I hadn't slept in so long. I'd been passing out. I hadn't really slept, so my body was tired. That was kind of a blessing, because otherwise that was what kind of cured that tremendous restless, irritable, and discontentedness in me for a while until I could start doing some of this. But I did see that left on my own devices, I was always going to take a drink. We get moments of clarity in our drinking, or for me, I did. I got a moment of clarity that was always getting worse. It was never getting better. It was never going to get better. And that was a moment of truth for me that made it so I could get in these doors, because if I had come in here when I needed it, that would have been 20 years ago before I got here. If I had come in when I wanted it, that would have been several times. You know, I did want it, you know, because I'd graced the doors of AA several times, and at times I did want my life to be different. But it was because it only happened when I would do what was being said. When I came here and would actually take the actions that would get me sober, that I got any results. So that's all I have. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, well, I mean, I've already covered, the insanity, always taking that drink. You know, for me, though, like, once I started doing this, my whole life changed. And that obsession, like, I didn't believe it. I didn't believe what you guys were selling. Not for a minute. But I had ideas. And, you know, and I really did buy into this whole thing. And, like, the first step's a dark step. There ain't nothing about, like, happy-go-lucky times here. Once in a while, I would go drink and things wouldn't happen. But there was far more times when something would happen. And, like, I was done fighting it. So, you know, I read through this with my sponsor sitting at Starbucks, and we went over it, and we really, you know, we had some lively conversation, and then we got moving on. We kept moving, and we got into step two, and we started, you know, going through We Agnostics and what you guys are going to do next time. But, like, once I started to, it says in here, God doesn't make too hard of terms on those who seek him. And once I started, like, it's crazy how quick the relief I got, where I went out one day and just cut my dad's grass without him even asking me. You know, I went home after a meeting one night, and I made an amends to my sister. No one even had to tell me. It was just, you know, when me and her were in the same room, I swear the temperature would drop 5 degrees. And I couldn't live like that, you know. She was visiting, and she was in the house, and I'm like, you know, I haven't talked to my sponsor, but there needs to be a conversation. And then, like, 4 months later, she's asking me to spend Christmas with her in Alabama. I was on probation. I couldn't go. But still, you know, like, this stuff, the second I started taking these simple actions and applying them to my life, things started changing rapidly. And, like, yeah, I fall off the beam, and I go right back to feeling that I want to punch a wall and stuff, but, like, the simple actions can put me right back on that beam, you know. These steps, you know, that's the biggest thing for me. What's insanity to me today? The definition. Going to a 12-step program and not taking the 12 steps. That is my definition of insanity. These steps have forever changed my life, you know, and it's what did it, that relationship with God. Forever thankful for that. That's all I got.
Thank you both. So we're right about out of time. There's a short paragraph. We'll just let Bill Wilson have the last word on page 43. Once more, The alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. All right, we're going to pass the seventh tradition basket. In accordance with the seventh tradition that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influence that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any announcements for the good of AA? Danny.
Everybody around the house is in the game. We got two of them. I'll make them quick. There's a positive we have in the month, May 30th through June 1st, $25 for registration. It's going to be a great time. It's down for Women 57th in Atlantic. If you want more information on that, see me after the meeting. Also, my home group, Downtown Young Sobers, will be having a workshop May 17th. That is a week from Saturday. And it's going to be 11 to 2. There's going to be bacon, and if you want to eat, you should bring something. If you don't bring something, I guess we'll still let you eat. There's going to be four speakers ranging from 1 to 20 years of sobriety. If you want any more information on that, there's a flyer on the table. Otherwise, see me after the meeting.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Anybody else? This home group, the Simple Actions group, and this yellow flyer, there's more like it on the table. the next Friday coming around, May 9th, right here in this room. That's Friday night. It starts at 6:30 p.m. And then we're going to resume again on Saturday morning at 9:15. And there'll be a potluck lunch on Saturday, May 10th. What we're going to do is have a big book study with Christy E. and Sammy G. They're coming down from Richmond, Virginia. They're going to take us through all 12 steps out of the big book during that time. So Friday night, and then resuming again on Saturday, potluck lunch on Saturday, so bring a dish if you wish. It's absolutely no charge, completely free, open to anyone. Everybody's welcome. So please, and in fact, everybody, home group members and everybody, let's take these yellow flyers out of here tonight. They won't do us any good next Monday to find them in our supply bin.
May 27th, Big Book again, dinner and meeting, or a regular meeting time at 5:30.
That Big Book again, Christ in St. Luke's Church, what day?
May
27th. All right, any other announcements? The Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group member, please see any one of us. Home group members, please raise your hand. All right. And not to embarrass you, we just want to welcome you. Is there anybody in the room tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? If we could just get your first name, that'd be great.
Marianne.
Hi, Marianne.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Hey, Tyrone. Hey, Tyrone. Welcome.
Welcome. Glad you're here. Anybody else? All right, there is literature available on that table. If you can fold it, it's free. The books we sell at cost, any home group member can help you out with that. And sponsorship question. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, there are two home group members will be up here afterwards. Do we know who they are? Victoria and Evan. They'll be up here at the table lingering, so if you want to ask about sponsorship, just have a question, just come on up. We'll help you out with that. And in closing, I'd like to, can we thank Patrick and Jill one time? Thank you. I'd like to thank everyone who participated in setting up the meeting. None of this stuff happens by accident. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight. All are welcome to attend the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at the Garden Spot of Norfolk, Plaza del Sol on 20... now I forgot. I knew the name, now I forgot the location. 22nd and Colonial, right?
Yeah.
Right across from Yorgo's. You want to read 164? Last two paragraphs?
My name's Evan, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Evan.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to us and to you. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, should we make a circle? Tyrone, would you lead us?
Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.
Works.
That's fine. That's better. I was like, man, I was like, I should say about this last paragraph.